usually early to AA meetings. Everywhere else in my life, I'm always running a few minutes behind, but AA meetings, I've learned to, I think sometimes we refer to it as the 2020 club, 20 minutes early and 20 minutes later, although sometimes I'm prone to showing up an hour early, helping set up and stick around for an hour afterwards till everybody's gone home. And that's the way I used to open and close bars too, so maybe some things don't change. I want to start by saying thanks to Steve for asking me to come down and speak. It's an honor always to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. Couple of quick things. My sobriety date is November 21st, 1998. I've got a sponsor who has a sponsor who has a sponsor. Sponsor other men in the program. I've had some things come up in my life in the last 2 or 3 years, which I'll talk about, which I've gone from one of those guys that showed up to 5 or 6 meetings a week to I'm grateful if I can get to 2 or 3. And it's funny because there was a time in my AA recovery where, I'll go to a meeting. And then I went through that period. And of course, then I got into the period where I was probably as addicted to going to meetings and the social events of AA as I was parties, and settled in kind of into a routine. And then life has a tendency of doing what life does, and things changed a little bit. And now I'm not able to get to as many because of the demands of particular responsibilities, but I still go regularly. I still involved in service work. I've got a home group, Yorktown Shoulder to Shoulder is my home group on Thursday nights in Yorktown, 7 p.m. It's a closed book study meeting. If you're ever there and you are an alcoholic, you're welcome to attend. I'm the secretary for that group, and I'll get into more of that later. So, I don't have any kind of special major stories to tell you. I'm just a run-of-the-mill drunk. I like to drink. I discovered that at about the age of 13. And I always say I did have the white light first euphoric, powerful experience when I finally got drunk for the first time. And I was one of those alcoholics that I was like the last kid on the block to get drunk. All my buddies were doing it. And we'd get somebody's older brother to buy us some beer, and we'd get out in the schoolyard, and man, I couldn't stand the taste of it. It was horrible. I was like, this is like rot gut stuff. I can't stand it. So we had one particular, and I grew up in Northern Virginia, up in Fairfax, and one particular winter time, January, February, and of course, in Northern Virginia, it gets a little colder, a little more snow on the ground. We had formed a group to buy, as I like to say, because that's a reference to Bill's story. Pulled our money together, got somebody's older brother to buy us like a case of beer. And I think there was like 4 or 5 of us, and I had claimed a 6-pack. And up until this time, I was lucky if I could even get half a beer in me. And I can still tell you it was, anybody remember Black Label? I don't even know if they make that beer anymore. They still make that beer, little brown bottles. Ugh. We had hidden the stuff in the snow in the schoolyard, gone home, and the deal was when our parents went to bed, we'd sneak out. It was like a Friday or Saturday night. We'd sneak out, get back down to the schoolyard, and knock them down. And I can remember getting down there and my buddies showing up and them all joking me and saying, ah, come on, man, you're not going to drink any beer. Give me your 6-pack. And I'm like, nah, I'm going to drink it. So I was bound and determined. And I remember I cracked open that first one and started chugging. And I don't know if it was the first time I'd ever had beer that cold, because it had been like buried in the snow for several hours. And man, it really went down fairly easily. And I was like, oh, okay. And I remember I was getting kind of that positive reinforcement from the buddies, the alcoholic's light. I already liked being the center of attention, whether it was good or bad. And cracked open that second one and got about maybe halfway through the second one when I felt that feeling. And if you're alcoholic, you know what feeling I'm talking about. I don't even have to describe it to you. And immediately began having the thoughts, so this is what this is all about. This is why my parents drank. This is why my buddies drank. And don't get me wrong, I didn't come from an alcoholic home. I came from a normal, regular, middle-class family. We didn't have a lot of money, but all my needs were met. My parents were very hardworking people. They would have get-togethers at the house on the weekends. They'd get folks to come over, a few drinks, play cards, that kind of stuff. But everybody had a good time. There were no fights. Nobody was puking in the bathroom. Nobody was passing out on the couch and peeing on themselves, all things that I would come to do later. So really my early childhood memories of drinking were associated with good times, fun. They're having fun. You know, my parents, their friends probably drank just enough to get that nice little smooth buzz that made them laugh a little more and joke a little more and become a little more talkative. And I don't remember hearing about hangovers and, you know, nobody got sick. And I remember one time my dad's cousin, and I don't know if he's alcoholic, he's elderly now, but my dad's cousin was at the house and he got sick. And I remember he had gone like into the upstairs far back of the house bathroom, but we could still hear him. He was so sick. And I'm probably like 7 or 8 years old and I'm asking my dad, "What's wrong with cousin Buster?" He says, "I don't know. He doesn't sound too good, does he?" And I remember him coming downstairs, and I'm young enough, I'm bold enough. I said, "You okay?" "Yeah," and he's green, man. He looks horrible, and he's sweating in the whole nine yards. He says, "Yeah, I'll be all right." I said, "Something, did you eat something made you sick?" "Yeah, I had too many crackers, I think." So I would be Buster later on, but I would be like that regularly. So, you know, what I know today and what Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me today is that I'm not alcoholic because I might have had a parent or other family member that was alcoholic, although that's true for me. Grandfather was alcoholic, great-grandfather was alcoholic. I'm not alcoholic because I was poor or rich or white or black or male or female or grew up in Northern Virginia or Southern Florida. I'm alcoholic because of how my body and my mind reacts to alcohol. And for a long time, I think I paid attention to the physical description of this disease, which says, you know, my body reacts differently. You know, Dr. Silkworth in the big book, Bill's psychiatrist, said, you know, what happens is the alcoholic's body is allergic to alcohol. And so when we consume alcohol in any amount, doesn't have to be a beer, it can be less than a beer, get just enough of that alcohol in my system, my body literally craves more of it. But I found that wasn't the toughest part of my disease. The toughest part of my disease is what this thing does when I'm not drinking. I remember hearing a speaker tape, and this guy was talking about the most insane thing he ever did. And he said, "I hear alcoholics sitting around the rooms and before meetings and after meetings telling all their drunk stories and the crazy stuff they did." And he said, "You know what the most insane thing I ever did? I did it stone sober. Every time I did this crazy, insane thing, I was stone sober." He said, "You know what it was? I picked up a drink knowing where it was going to take me." Whew. Boy, that resonated with me. And that's the craziest thing I ever did, was knowing what the drink was going to do to me, where it was going to take me. And to be perfectly honest, the only thing I knew is it wasn't going to be good. I didn't know the particulars. I didn't know exactly when I was going to stop. I didn't know, was I going to get into trouble? Was I going to hurt somebody? My story doesn't have a lot of legal. I never got a DUI. I could have had 1,000 of them. I don't know why, if that's luck, bad luck. I never got a DUI. Could have had 1,000 of them though. Got in accidents, wrecked cars, hurt people, got in fights, all the stuff that we do. But I'm alcoholic because my body reacts differently. And I haven't had a drink in some time. I haven't had a drink in over 19 years. But I truly believe today that if I went around to the corner of the 7-Eleven, if I could do that, I know I can't because God's removed that compulsion, but if I could and got that drink, it wouldn't take much and it wouldn't take long before I was not only right back where I was, but probably worse off. Because as you've, I'm sure all of you've heard, in fact, I got a question. Is there any newcomers in here tonight? Anybody in their first 180 days, brand new? Oh, great. Room full of old timers. Awesome. All right, well, I'm going to go home. Y'all know what's going on. So a little bit of my story. Proceeded forward kind of as a weekend warrior through high school. My first drunk was at age 13. Really loved it. Did the weekend warrior thing. Then it got to be whenever I could get my hands on it. My senior year of high school, I'd discover that magic stuff that they put in a bag called marijuana. And that went along with my drinking. And those two things started to fuel my poor attitude, lack of caring about anything. Sports went away. Grades, if they were halfway decent, really plummeted. And it was about my senior year. I'm probably about 17, my senior year of high school, when people were starting to comment on my drinking and the way I would behave. A couple quick stories. One, I remember I was supposed to get together with my girlfriend at the time and a couple of her friends, and we had this big government, you know, take government your senior year in high school. We had this big government project we were working on, and I went to go participate in this. And of course, I probably didn't even have a notebook or a pen with me, but I showed up under the influence. And I remember the look on her face when I walked into her house to the study session. And then I remember she said, "Can I talk to you for a second?" And she took me like in the side room and she said, "You're messed up." And I'm like, "No, I'm not messed up. I got a little buzz, but I'm not messed up." She said, "You're messed up. I can't believe." She goes, "I can't remember the last time I saw you and you were straight." Of course, you know, I'm 17. I'm doing what 17-year-olds do, right? And that, you know, that's what I thought. That's one story that sticks out in my mind. Another one, junior, senior year of high school, Northern Virginia. We get a big bunch of snow, so it's a snow day. They shut down the school. We've got plenty of booze on tap. And I get out in the car, and this is, I'm blackout drinking at this point. I get out in the car with a buddy of mine and his girlfriend, and I'm sitting in the back seat. It's not even his car, he's borrowed it. We're going like up to the store for a pizza or something. I'm so drunk, I'm seeing double, and I'm sitting in the back seat. And I remember telling him, "Hey, I want to drive." And I'm an easygoing, laid-back guy. I'm telling you, I'll get mad, but not severely. But when I was drunk, it was like a whole other ball game with me. So I remember saying from the back seat, "Hey, I want to drive." And I remember him kind of looking over his shoulder like, "Yeah, right, that's not happening." And so, like, I think I said it to him with a little bit more intention in my voice. "Hey, I want to drive." And he said, "Larry, I'm not going to let you drive. You're going to get in an accident. You can't drive. You can't even walk." And so then I say something very vulgar to him, and I threaten him in front of his girlfriend. And I say, "If you don't let me drive, I'm going to kick your tail up one side and down the other." And I was much bigger than him. Not a tough guy, but I can pretend to be one. And it scared him. He pulled over the car. Him and his girlfriend got out of the car. They said, "Go ahead. Go ahead. Drive the car." And I was like, "Well, get in." "Oh, no." So that told me that he probably had enough sobriety to drive that day, because he knew well enough that, one, he didn't want to get beat up by a drunk who was out of his mind, and two, he wasn't gonna get in the car. That sticks out in my mind. I had to make amends to that guy. And he vaguely even remembered it himself, but anyway, so that's the kind of thing, the way alcohol was beginning to affect my life. I joined the military out of high school because my grades are, you know, not good at all. I do okay in the military. I end up convincing a high school sweetheart to drop out of college and come join me and marry me. Woo! That was bad news. I took my first hostage. Yeah, God bless her. That lasted about a year. And so what was happening to me at that point in my life, I'll tell that because now alcohol is not quite enough for me anymore. And one of the reasons I joined the military was because I was beginning to develop a little bit of a drug habit. I knew, you know, that's not good. It's illegal. I can't keep doing that. I knew the military wasn't tolerating that anymore, but I could drink. And I joined the Navy, for any of you that are ex-Navy. And back in the mid-80s in the Navy, drinking was still pretty much encouraged. I don't think it's that way today. It's a different Navy today, but back then it was definitely encouraged. But you were encouraged not to get in trouble either. I did a stint of 6 years in the military, got out, went back to college, and got married to a girl I met, first wife gone, right? That first, I freed that hostage, no children. Get married the second time, have 3 children. About the time I'm in my mid-20s, I've graduated from college. I get a really good job up in Richmond, working for a nonprofit group. I'm getting exposed to a lot of really neat opportunities, and my drinking is just out of control. That job, I might have held it down for about 90 days, probably about 3 months. And you know, I don't think I was probably being close to being fired, but I felt that way, and so I quit that job, walked away from that job. And then I would spiral down drastically over the next year. I was unemployable. I'd hold down a few jobs, $5 an hour. Here I'm on with a college degree, making $5 an hour. You know, at the time, that was a little bit above minimum wage. And things were just out of control. My wife then, my second wife at the time, was she didn't put the drinking to my problems. But she's like, you're depressed all the time. You're angry. What's going on with you? What's the matter? And of course, at that point, I'm like, leave me alone. You know, I'm okay. You people are driving me nuts. You know, the kids are driving me nuts. You're driving me nuts. It was everybody else's fault. So things start to get really dark for me. And I'm to a point where not only am I unemployed, but I'm not even really participating in the house anymore. And I can tell you, at this time in my life, I'm 26, 27. I want to be a good dad. I want to be a good husband. I want to be a good employee. I want to be a good brother, a good friend. I couldn't be none of that. I was not measuring up in any way imaginable. I wasn't even barely making the grade. I was the drunk on the couch. And I was either out of the house getting booze, or in the house consuming booze, or passed out on the couch. And I literally did that for about a year straight. And God bless my wife at the time. My kids were still fairly young, but it was affecting the whole family. So we had moved. We had lived in Virginia Beach when I got out of the military. I'd gotten a job in Richmond. My wife then was still working in Norfolk. So we were looking for a halfway point between Richmond and Norfolk. We moved to a little town called Gloucester. Didn't know a damn thing about Gloucester before I got there. But it was out in the country. It seemed quaint, seemed nice. Cost of living was much cheaper than what it was in Virginia Beach. We could get more house for the money. So we moved there. Now, when I came out of college, I was what I would call not only an agnostic, I was an atheist. So it wasn't that I doubted whether or not God existed. There was no God as far as I was concerned. And I took great intellectual pride in that. So I called myself an egotistical atheist is what I was. And had no desire to practice any religion, no spirituality whatsoever. So imagine, you know, my life spiraling downwards. This is my mindset. But little did I know how much my higher power was already working in my life just when I moved to Gloucester. I move in to a neighborhood that has a recovering alcoholic right across the street. Somebody had been in AA for, I think at that point, had been in AA for about 13 years. Had no idea. Just knew it was another family across the street. As I'm getting sicker, I'm watching my children spend a lot of time at that house across the street, because my house wasn't a pleasant place to be, not when I was there anyways. And so as things are getting worse for me, this neighbor starts to reach out to me. And I'm telling you, I'm lucky if I'm taking a bath once a week. I mean, I'm getting bad. And beard down to my stomach. I'm most of the time in a greasy t-shirt and sweatpants. I mean, I look like some half-retired biker, and I'm like 28, 29 years old. And I'll never forget, later on, I would talk to this woman. It was a woman that was in recovery. And I said, you never saw me drink. You never saw me drug. You never saw me in that state of mind. How did you know? And she said, well, there was a couple things. One thing is, when you moved into the neighborhood, you were clean cut. You used to wear a coat and tie to work every morning. Then suddenly you weren't going to work. Then suddenly you've got the long hair and the beard. You're not getting dressed. You know? She said, you could see another human being spiraling downwards. And she said, just some of the things that you said and some of the things that you did reminded me when I was in active addiction. So this person would begin to talk to me. And I'm telling you, I looked like a total bum. And in my sick alcoholic mind, I'm thinking, maybe she's hitting on me. Maybe she's interested. hey, I got all this going on. No job, not bathing regularly, long beard, unkempt, stink probably. And God bless her soul. I saw this woman across the street who was outside raking leaves with kids in the fall time, making apple cider, baking cookies, playing games. It was like Ozzie and Harriet. It was like Leave It to Beaver across the street, and it made me sick. And I'll never forget, she did a couple things to reach out to me. And one thing was, and this will date me a little bit, she brought a cassette tape over to the house. And I think before this, she had dropped off a big book at my house. And it was so funny how she did the big book thing. And she handed me, it was back then when we had the third edition, and it was softbound just like this, so you really couldn't read the title of it. And she said, have you been to college, right? Oh, yeah, I went to college. Never mind, I don't have a job, but yeah, I went to college. And she said, you're a smart guy, you like to read? I said, oh, yeah, read 300-400 pages a week. She said, I got this book, maybe you ought to check it out. I found a lot of wisdom in this book, you ought to read it. And I can remember like flipping open the page and finally realizing it's Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm like, Alcoholics Anonymous? And I'm thinking, why the heck would she give me a book on alcohol? Anyway, so I remember reading, it's funny how this happens. I remember seeing the chapter We Agnostics, and I immediately kind of went to that because I knew what agnosticism was. And then I remember reading how it was more like trying to gear you towards a spiritual way of life. That book went across the room, probably went in a garbage can. So the next thing she did, she brings me this cassette tape. And I'll never forget the exchange. She knocks on the door one day. She says, hey, how are you doing? And I'm, you know. And she says, hey, I got this tape I want you to listen to. And I'm like, oh, okay. And it looks like a blank tape you'd make copies on. I said, so some new band or something? And she says, no, it's not a band. She said, just listen to it when you get a chance. And it'd probably be good if you were by yourself, but it's okay if you got other people around, but you might be able to focus a little more on it when you're by yourself. And I'm thinking, okay, this is weird. That's all I remember her saying about it. And so one day I'm in the house and I put the tape on the stereo and I listen. And I didn't hear like the first minute or so, but I could hear this woman's voice talking, and I could hear some people chuckling in the background. And she's telling a story. And this woman sounds like the woman across the street, but I'm not, her name was Kathy. Sounds like Kathy, but I'm not real sure. And she's talking about living with a bike gang and selling heroin out of the back door and drinking and wild parties and just all this crazy insanity like nothing I'd ever experienced. And I'm thinking, I don't know whose story this is, but it's not Susie Homemaker over there across the street, that's for sure, you know? And I run into her again next day or so, and she asked me, she says, hey, did you get a chance to listen to that tape? And I said, yeah. I said, who the heck was that? It was me. I said, well, whose story are you telling? She said, mine. And I said, I said, if you expect me to believe you were, you know, dating and living with a guy in a bike club and doing all this crazy wild stuff. Oh, yeah, no, that was my life. That's exactly how I was living. You know, and at that time she was married to a nice guy in the Coast Guard and two kids and two cars in the garage and a nice home and all that stuff. You know, it was really hard for me to put two and two together. Well, things got really bad very quickly for me. And she reached out to me one day when I was really low. And I had not been able to get the kids on the bus. Imagine that. And that was like my job now. It's like Mr. Dad, Mr. Mom, stay-at-home dad. But I wasn't doing that. I wasn't doing nothing. And she gives me a call. How are you doing? I said, I'm not doing good at all. She said, you want to talk? I said, nope, don't want to talk. I appreciate you calling. She said, are the kids okay? Yep, kids are fine. She goes, well, I just didn't see anybody on the bus. I was just worried. I want to make sure everybody's okay. And I said, yeah, everybody's good. I got to go. Click. And I began ruminating in my mind about how much trouble I was in, because by this point, every day is hell. And every day is dark. And every day starts out with, I'm not going to drink today. I'm not going to use some substance today. And that might last until 10 o'clock in the morning. It might make it till 5 o'clock in the evening. But invariably, at some point throughout the day, I would find the reason or the justification in my own mind that made sense to me. I'm just going to run up to the store and get a six-pack. That's all I need. I just need something to take the edge off. You know, and then I would, of course, go well beyond that and wake up the next morning or whenever I would come to, and, you know, that what's Bill telling his story about the next morning, you know, the pure darkness and despair, and because he's talking about the four horsemen, you know, coming to visit you, and that's where I was. And it was like I was living Groundhog Day, you know, that movie where the guy keeps waking up to the same day over and over again. But it was really dark. And I was suicidal. I didn't want to live anymore. I didn't want to do this thing anymore. I don't see any way out. And the one thing in the back of my mind was that I didn't want my children to grow up with a father who had killed himself. I remember that was the one thing that was kind of keeping me going. And I remember my mother must have seen the signs, because I remember my mother at one point getting me alone and saying, you know, if anything ever happened to you, they'd have to lock me up in the funny farm. I said, what are you talking about? I'm just saying, you mean so much to me that if anything happened to you, I'd lose it. And so those things are ruminating around in my mind on a daily basis, and I'm trying to go through the day on my own and stay sober. And I can tell you what, for this alcoholic, I need a lot of help. I need a lot of help from you guys, from a higher power, from this program, from 12 Steps. Not only to get sober, but to stay sober. And for today, it's not real hard to stay sober today, but I'll tell you what, it's still a work in progress on staying sane and living life on life's terms. What happens to me first when I know I'm not on the beam is my thinking goes south real quick. So I'm in this state of mind, and I remember the neighbor telling this crazy wild story, and I thought, and I'm hiding my life. My wife's knows something's up, but she doesn't know how much alcohol, and for me, I'd gotten back into the drugs at that point, how much I'm consuming. I'm hiding, and I'm doing a fairly good job of hiding the evidence of that, but all the fruits of my alcoholism are manifesting themselves with sporadic crazy behavior, and I'm going to kill myself one minute, the next minute I'm going to kill some guy that I ran into on the road, or, you know, I'm crazy, I'm just talking out of my head. And I call that neighbor back. I said, hey, Kathy, it's Larry, and, I think I need to talk to somebody. And she said, oh, man, you want to come over here and talk? Yeah, I do. Can I come over? Yeah. So I remember I went and took a shower, because she might be interested in me. And I put on some clean clothes. I probably even brushed my teeth for the first time that week. She wants all this. And I go over to her house, and for some reason I thought, you know, if that's her story, if she really was that wild, anything I tell her is not going to surprise her. It's not going to shock her. So I go in there, and I sit down, and she says, what's going on? She puts the kids out in the backyard playing. What's going on? I said, I'm losing it. And she said, I can tell you're struggling. What's going on? And I said, I'm going to tell you something, and you got to promise me you don't tell anybody. And she was friends with my wife. I said, you can't tell Lisa, you can't tell anybody. She said, I'll tell you what, I'll make you a deal. Whatever you're getting ready to tell me, I won't tell anybody. But if I feel like you're really in trouble, I may try to convince you you need to talk to somebody else. And I said, okay, that's a deal. She goes, but I'm not going to share what you're sharing with me. I said, okay. So I look at her and I said, I think I might have a drug, maybe even an alcohol problem. And this big grin peels across her face, and then she starts laughing. Now I've just revealed what I think is the biggest, deepest, darkest, awful secret. You know, perfect Larry, who has it all together, who's got a college degree and no job and doesn't bathe on a regular basis, but is still perfect in his own mind in some way, has just revealed what a failure he is, and she's laughing, right? And so she sees the look on my face, and she says, I'm sorry. She says, you know, I'm sorry, Larry, I'm not laughing at you. She says, I'm relieved. And I said, how could you possibly be relieved? She says, because now I know what the problem is. And she said, here's the good news. There is a solution. There is a solution. You don't have to live this way anymore if you don't want to. And, of course, you know, my response to that is, you know, right, you know, shake my head with doubt. And so she began to talk to me about her journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she began to talk about going to meetings. And she began to talk about how she was scared at first and how she would sit in her first weeks of meetings and feel uncomfortable and not feel like she related. But then she would talk about the development of where her recovery journey had taken her over the last 13 years and how she'd gotten a sponsor and how she'd worked this thing called steps. And of course, you know what happens when we get here. We don't know what the heck. What are you talking about? Steps? What steps? You know, what's a sponsor? What's, you know, what is that stuff? And so she's telling me all this, but she convinced me, or I felt convinced, and she didn't try to convince me, she just shared with me her experience. And just like Ebbie Thatcher, 80-some years ago, sharing his experience with Bill Wilson, that's what's happened, and that's why this thing works, from one alcoholic to another, is we share openly and honestly about how much daggone pain we were in when we were drinking, and how Alcoholics Anonymous and a higher power got us out of that hole. And that's exactly what she shared with me. She didn't have to make up any grand argument. She didn't have to get passionate about it. She just quietly shared her experience with me, and I was convinced. I was convinced she knew what she was talking about. I was convinced that her life was at one time a living, dark hell, and that she had come up out of that, and that by some form of grace, which I didn't believe in, she came up out of that. And so I didn't know if I was ready to become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous or do all the things you all did, but she convinced me of one thing, and that was to go to my first meeting that night. And she said, I want to have, there's two friends of mine that will come and get you tonight, pick you up and take you to a meeting. And will you go? And of course, I was scared to death because I'm thinking it's going to be like church, and they're going to be praying over me, and people are going to be shouting in tongues and jumping around. I don't know what to expect, you know. And trying to convert me, right? Y'all are going to try to convert me. You're going to try to get me to drink the Kool-Aid, you know, whatever it is. And you guys did get me to drink the Kool-Aid, but it was coffee and cookies. and working 12 steps. That's the Kool-Aid. And I remember I was scared to death and I asked, do I have to say anything? Oh, no, you don't say anything. Do I have to talk to anybody? No, you don't have to talk to anybody. She said, but I promise you there's going to be people there that are going to want to say hello and shake your hand and just introduce themselves. And you don't have to tell, you can just say, my name's Larry, thanks. You don't say anything else. So I go to that meeting, and there's a higher power that I don't believe in that's already been working in my life because he's put this woman in a neighborhood that I never imagined moving to, that we just haphazardly chose. She recognizes that I've got a problem. She doesn't worry about the fact that I'm a male. She still reaches out to me for help. I take that help. This higher power is working. I go to my first AA meeting, and I'm sitting there, and I'm listening, and it's not a lot of people, probably half the amount of people that are in here tonight that are sharing around a small table. And I'm not hearing much of anything until it gets to this one guy. And this one guy is sharing about coming back from a hunting trip in West Virginia. And he's coming down 95 or 81, one of those roads, and somebody had cut them off. And he was passed out in the back of the car, half hungover, half drunk. And he felt the car kind of swerve, and they locked the brakes up for a second, and he heard the driver kind of swearing. And he sat up in the back seat, he said, what's going on? And he said, the driver said, man, that guy just cut us off. And he said, as the driver pulled around and starts to pass the car, he reaches down on the floorboard, unsheaths his 12-gauge shotgun, loads three shells in it, and out the window is trying to blow the guy's tires out. You know? And here's the best part. The guy's an attorney, a lawyer. And that caught my attention. And I thought, that guy's crazy. He's crazier than I am. And then he began to share about the hell he had put his family through in the last couple of years of his drinking especially. And I began to feel the tears in my own eyes because I realized how much hell I'd been putting my family through and wishing that I had not. but powerless, completely powerless to do anything about it. We're completely powerless to fight this disease on our own, to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, to tighten up our belts and get it together. I was told, I can't remember countless times, by my father, by my mother, by teachers, coaches, whoever wanted to talk to me would say, Larry, you're such a nice guy, you're a smart kid, why can't you just get it together? I couldn't get it together, I'm an alcoholic. And by the very definition of the word, I am powerless. I don't have the necessary power. I can be smart, I can be intelligent, I can be physically strong, but when it comes to alcoholism, if I'm an alcoholic, I am never going to win. I need help. I need help. And instead of fighting it, I've got to surrender. I have to surrender to the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in this program. And by that very surrender, by giving up and recognizing that I need help, I begin to get hope, and then I begin to do these things, and then my whole life begins to change. So I hear this attorney's story, and he catches my ear, and so at the end of the meeting, I don't say anything. At the end of the meeting, they come up, they hand me a meeting directory or whatever, and all I'm thinking about is I want to get to this guy and talk to him. So I go outside, he's sitting outside, and he's talking to some folks, and he sees me, and I can't remember exactly what he said. I remember he told me, he said, you may not understand this now, but everybody in this room loves you, even though we don't know you. We do know you. We know what you're struggling with. And we all love you. And he said, you don't have to live this way anymore. That's what my neighbor Kathy had told me. And I would start to go and talk to that guy. I would travel over to Williamsburg from Gloucester, and I would meet with him, and he would be my first sponsor. And I remember him telling me when I finally heard the full story. Now, this Matthews County was where I went to my first meeting. And for you guys that are from this area, probably don't know anything about Matthews County, but it is remote. I think there's one traffic light. No, there's no traffic lights in the whole county, but there is a light on a drawbridge that when the drawbridge is open, that light turns red. That's the only light there is out there. And that happened to be my first meeting, just because that was where the meeting was closest that night. He traveled all the way from Williamsburg, which is about an hour and a half away from Matthews County, to 12 Step, an old hunting buddy. The old hunting buddy didn't show up, and he almost turned around to go back home. But something inside of him said, I'm here, the meeting's getting ready to start. I'm gonna go have an AA meeting. And little did he know, he came out there to 12 Step me. And that's exactly what happened. And so I'd love to tell you that from then on it was roses and pageantry and beautiful sunny skies, and you know, it was tough. It was hard. I had many trying times. I went about 8.5 months without a drink, and then for some reason I decided it was okay, that maybe I didn't have it as bad as I thought I did. And I was fortunate because I got really, really sick, and I came right back in 24 hours later and picked up another white chip, and that was November 21st of 1998, and I haven't had a drink since. And I don't really think about drinking today, but I will tell you that living life on life's terms can still be a struggle sometimes. So maybe talk a little bit. I'm not paying attention to time. Stop at about 5 till. Is that about right? So my AA journey, I would start to do some of the things, especially after the relapse. I would come back in. I would see the unconditional love that we talk about here. I remember I had the relapse. I got really sick. The next night I was scheduled to go to a meeting with my sponsor. And I'd gotten a sponsor in Gloucester by this point. And I went to the meeting hungover, sick as a dog. I didn't say anything to him about it. The next morning I picked up the phone and I called him and I told him. A guy named John out in Gloucester, John P. John Paws, he announces his whole name and meanings. And I called John up the next morning. I said, man, I screwed up. He says, what do you mean you screwed up? I said, I drank. He said, you drank last night? We were at the meeting last night. When I dropped you off at 10 o'clock, you drank after I dropped? No, the night before. Friday night, I drank Friday night. Oh, man, you didn't say anything last night. He goes, I didn't know. He goes, you looked a little green around the gills, but I didn't know you'd been drinking the night before. I said, oh, man, I got sick as a dog. It was horrible. He says, well, what do you want to do? I said, can we get together and talk? He says, yeah. He says, you're going to go to the meeting tonight? And I said, yeah. It was Sunday night. He says, I'll meet you there about half hour before. Let's meet an hour before the meeting. I said, okay. So I'm thinking I'm going to go there. I'm going to tell John everything. And he's going to just say, you know what? See ya. You know, sorry. I tried to help you. I remember he said, tell me what happened. I told him. And he said, well, do you want to go to the meeting? I said, yes, I do. He goes, what do you want to do about your recovery? And I said, I want to try again. And he says, are you willing to pick up a white chip tonight? I said, absolutely. He says, are you willing to recommit yourself to this? Do you feel like you're really done? I said, I feel like I'm really done. And I remember he opened up his arms and he gave me a hug. And I remember thinking, wow. You know, in the past when I'd screw up, I'd get yelled at or fired or kicked out of the house. And I screwed up here and this guy's giving me a hug and encouraging me to try again. That was amazing. That was amazing. And I continue to feel that love in these rooms. I hope that each one of you have felt that at one time or another, continue to feel it. I feel it regularly. I recently, I'll share real quick, I recently have gone through a tough time. Been sober quite a while and have done a lot of different service work and carried meetings into jails, sponsored guys, been very involved in my district. Very active in AA, and it's been wonderful ride. And about almost 3 years ago, now I had three children from the marriage that I had when I came into AA, and they're all in their 20s. They're all grown. My youngest is 21, and my oldest is 27. Unfortunately, me and her, their mother didn't last, and we got divorced. It's okay. We're good friends today. We get along. But the marriage didn't last, and that was 12, 13 years ago. I met a woman in AA who I was very leery about in the beginning. I thought she was crazy, even crazier than me. There's a lot of debate about who's crazier nowadays. Anyway, she was significantly younger than me. We dated for a while. Long story short, we got married. She had never had children. I'm 47. My children are in their 20s. I'm done. And I said, you know what? I'm willing to do it one more time. And so we had a baby boy 3 years ago this July. Well, I can tell you that it's been a real true blessing and a second chance, because when my older kids were that age, the first year or two, I was still drinking. And so I didn't get to experience a whole lot of that. And I'm significantly older, so something about having children at an older age makes it completely different. But it's been a real blessing. But it's put a huge cramp on my social and AA life. And I don't get an opportunity to go to as many meetings as I want to. And I've recognized that my schedule shifts and changes. My wife now is a nurse. And any of you that know a nurse, they work crazy schedules. There's no guaranteed days, and it's weekends, it's middle of the week, it's late at night, it's early in the morning. And so I've got to be the primary caregiver when she's at work. And it's really caused me to juggle things a lot. And I got to kind of a dark place about 6 months ago. And I couldn't really put my finger on what was going on. I didn't feel like drinking, but I just felt depressed. I'd taken on a new job that was with a lot of responsibility and a lot of good things. A lot of good things happening, but I just felt down. And, you know, I can look back now and see that that regular old alcoholism was beginning to kind of take back over. I wasn't going to as many meetings. I wasn't talking to people as much. I wasn't able to connect with my sponsor as regularly. So I've recognized I had to make some changes. The home group that I used to go to, I changed that. I got a new home group. I ended up changing sponsors and getting with someone that I could meet with more regularly. It was very scary going through that process, but you guys taught me that I need to continue to take action. That if I sat and stew in my head about it and try to think my way out of it, it just gets worse. But I can tell you, I took some action. I made some changes, but it was all about just getting reinvigorated in AA. And these changes have been a good thing. And I feel so much better today. I feel back at the heart of AA, and I think I felt like I was starting to drift away. And not because, again, anything bad, but just because responsibilities in life started to change, and I think that happens from time to time. And I think the other danger is, too, and maybe some of you have experienced that, the longer you're in AA and the longer you're sober, the more you begin to think, not that I can rest on my laurels, but hey, I don't have to do as much service work. I don't have to hit as many, I don't have to call my sponsor all the time. And you know what? If I do too much of that, I'm going to suffer. And that's exactly what happened to me. So it just taught me. It was kind of like a wake-up call for me. It was a wake-up call that it doesn't matter if I've been in here for 9 minutes, 9 years, or 90 years, that I'm still alcoholic, that I'm still prone to all the things that come with having this disease, the crazy, twisted mental perception if I'm not checking in with you guys regularly, if I'm not checking in with my higher power. And so I got to continue to work at this. I got to continue to be active. I got to continue to do this thing. And I'm just grateful. That's the best way I could describe it today. I'm grateful. My life's not perfect. I've got a very stressful job, but it's a good job. It pays me well. I'm chasing around a two-year-old, and I'm almost 50. I get accused of being his granddaddy all the time. I'm in the grocery store, and people say, "Is that your granddad for grandbaby?" I say, "Well, he could be, but he's actually my son." But you know what? Life is good. Life is good sober, and life is good as long as I stay in the heart of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hang out with you guys, and I share with you openly and honestly about where I'm at. That really helped me a lot. But this time, when I was struggling, I wasn't afraid to share that I was struggling. I was sharing it in my home group. I was sharing it with my close friends. I was sharing it with my sponsor. You know, hey, I'm not feeling good. No, I'm not feeling like drinking. No, I'm not going to kill myself or kill anybody else. But you know, I'm not feeling good. I definitely was not feeling happy, joyous, and free. And so, but you guys have drilled it into my head for years and years that what's that mean? I got to step up my game. I got to get involved. I got to do this thing. I like that. I'll close. Oh, shoot, I'm running a little bit over. But let me just read this real quick, and then I'll shut up. Again, thank you all tonight for everything and allowing me to come down here and share. I like this section on 100, and some of you have probably heard this a million times, but I'll read it anyways. This is page 100, first full paragraph. Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances are. And to me, that's a big promise. It tells me no matter how bad it is right now, if I'm willing to commit myself to following this program in a higher power, my life will get incredibly better, and I've experienced that over and over again. Thank you, guys. I love y'all.